Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. She is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. She has loosed the fateful lightning of her terrible swift sword. Her truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Her truth is marching on. Why sing an anthem about war on Mother's Day? Mother's Day really is not supposed to be about war, not about conflict or struggle, or is it? Maybe if I were to reread that list that Amy Young so tenderly named, we would recognize that terrain that all mothers traverse in their campaign with their children, that it might outline the battlefield that we have all experienced, where heartache and sorrow and worry is pitted against devotion and hope and prayer and joy. And it might point out the sacrifices experienced and the casualties endured. The truth is that I asked to sing this morning the battle hymn of the Republic for two simple reasons. First, it is one of the first songs that I ever learned, and I fell in love with it the first time that I heard it. It had a cadence that made me want to stand up and march, and the melody helped me feel inspired and bolder than I probably was, and the words, I never really remembered the words that well, and certainly nothing beyond the first verse. But I sang it anyway, very loudly and proudly, over and over. And I always sang it with one particular interesting twist, for reasons that were unknown even to me at the time. I sang it with the pronouns she and her instead of he and his. And it wasn't like I hadn't already encountered a world very eager to point out that God was a he. But somehow this particular song just seemed so stridently defiant and different than everything else, the change seemed very appropriate. But the reason all of that sticks into my mind is one particular episode that happened one year when I was marching around singing this as my own personal anthem, which probably gives you an idea of what kind of little boy I was and why I turned out the way I did. But on this particular day, my mother happened to overhear me singing this, and as I saw her listening, I noticed that she paused and she had one of those looks of great curiosity where her ears practically bent forward. And she stopped me and she asked me to sing it again, and I did, and she smiled. But suddenly aware that something might not be right, I asked her if I had gotten it right, and she said, "Oh yeah, you definitely got it right." The second reason for singing this hymn was because it was written by a woman who was feisty and unconventional, strong of character, firm in her convictions, and ready to do battle for her causes, just like my mom. And like my mom, she was a Unitarian. But before I go deeper into that, I want to explore the first reason, the idea of God, and specifically the idea of God as feminine. When I was six, discovering the battle hymn of the Republic and singing about God as she, I wasn't trying to make a statement. It wasn't a conscious choice as much as it was intuition, sort of a cultural Freudian slip. And when I've tried to imagine what seed planted such intuition, I realized something important. I grew up in the 60s. It was a time when everywhere you looked, there was a questioning of norms, a stretching of assumptions and boundaries, breaching that yoke of authority. And everywhere, people were breaking things down and redefining what they meant. Civil rights was raising the questions of oppression and liberation, and those questions were then be taken up by ecologists and the poor and the working class and the gay community and, of course, women. It was a time when things like environmentalism was becoming its own religion, as was the labor movement and social activism, as was the sexual revolution and the drug culture. And as each of these different cultures began to forge and project a clear identity, not only did the world begin to change, but so did the image of God that these cultures were projecting out onto the culture. And almost overnight, we were exploring liberation theology, environmental theology, process theology, and of course, feminist theology. All these rapidly expanding understandings had a profound impact on religion at large. But for Unitarian Universalism in particular, feminist theology had an enormous influence. Within a few years of the feminist movement, a commission was appointed at the UUA to create a new hymnal that used inclusive language, playing with the pronouns and the image of God. It is the hymnal that we now enjoy. And applications to our seminaries began to pour in from women who wanted to become UU ministers. And we went from 10% female clergy in the 1960s to over 50% in the 1990s. And add to that the curriculum, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, which swept through seminaries and congregations, recalling into awareness long-forgotten understandings of matriarchal communities and feminine aspects of the divine that have appeared in a variety of cultures all throughout history. Now let me quickly fast forward through 40 years of cultural conversation that occurred between religion and psychology and history and culture that has led to a very powerful and poignant conversation that is now unfolding in our time, and that is the notion of the kind of God liberated enough to rise above constraints of gender. Some of you have noticed in the 2 years that I've been here that I have a habit of freely exchanging pronouns for God, sometimes referring to God as her and sometimes as him. I do this not intentionally to confuse you. Well, I'll admit, I actually do that to intentionally confuse you. But I do that because I feel like it is valuable to try and break us out of conventions that have imposed unnecessary and unhelpful restrictions on how we view this overarching and unifying web that unites and moves through each of us, and how we're in relationship to it, and how that thinking affects all of the relationships that we enter into. There is a new conversation about God emerging today which integrates liberation theology, process theology, feminist theology, and Jungian psychology, and it posits a new take on God, an image of God with two powerful archetypal manifestations, the divine masculine and the divine feminine. The divine masculine is the side of God we are most familiar with. It has been in the dominant framework employed over the last several thousand years to present a God of he and who presents a dominant, in control, transcendent, outwardly focused perspective, determined to go forth and convert the world and its people toward righteousness. The call of this God is toward dominion over, and when necessary, this God conquers any alternative or heretical impulse. The divine feminine, on the other hand, is inwardly focused. It is receptive, it is welcoming, it is intuitive, it integrates and it draws in experiences, envelops ideas, germinates and reconfigures, and eventually births new ideas and understandings. And rather than divide and conquer as its focus, it brings things together and transforms. It favors coalescence and collaboration rather than extending divine proclamation and judgment. A political model based on divine masculine would be more like that kingdom on a mountaintop surrounded by an army. The divine feminine would be more like a commune in a lush valley with a soup kitchen. A religious model of the divine masculine would be like the Jehovah's Witnesses who go out door to door and express their devotion by talking you to death, where the divine feminine is more like the Quakers who invite you in and express their devotion by not talking to you to save your life. Understanding that there are two sides to God is helpful, but it is essential to understand that both sides are necessary to restore a world that is out of balance. The masculine side of God without the feminine will raise its people to be arrogant and contentious and competitive and warlike, and this is largely what we have seen in our culture. But just as bad would be the feminine side of God without the masculine, which produces people who are self-absorbed, full of inward rumination, indecisive, and passive. And just as essential as seeing these two sides is to realize that these two sides have absolutely nothing to do with gender. Women are learning how to embody the divine masculine in the same way that men are needing to understand how to integrate the divine feminine, the purpose of which is not just about God being in good relationship with her children. It's about us all learning how to be in good relationship with ours. My mother was a frontline feminist. She learned to parent among the culture war of the 1960s when, for the first time, the fairness of women's oppression in a male-dominated society was being openly questioned. My mom had not only seen the casualties of patriarchy and prejudice against women, she had herself been wounded. My mom read the Masculine Manifesto while in line for bra-burning and assertiveness training classes. She felt for the first time that it was possible for a woman to break free from the Victorian gender norms that were carried forward and planted in America by the Puritans. And she felt it essential to learn more masculine tendencies as she became liberated into a world of single parenthood where she was forced to be both the breadwinner and the nurturer of her children's souls. My mom had three children, which meant that she was outnumbered. But she recognized that our home was only one of the battles in the larger war that she fought. Every day, she had to go out and earn a living, have some sanity for herself, care for her children and her family. And every day, there was more to do than time to do it. And so she coped by learning how to bark out commands and be very judgmental and opinionated. She could be very domineering, and some of the mantras that she expressed are still stuck in my head. If you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. Don't move. If it had teeth, it would bite you. If I have to tell you one more time, don't cry or I'll show you something worth crying about. Keep your hands to yourself. I don't care if it's not fair. The only fair I know of is in Kansas. I swear to God, I'll turn this car around right now. Don't spill. I'll be there in a minute. I told you not to spill. You just hold on, mister. Well, don't just sit there with your teeth in your mouth. Do something. If everyone was going to jump off a cliff, to the ears of a little boy, these messages could be very confusing. I grew up watching June Cleaver on TV and Aunt Bay Aunt Bea of Mayberry, and Mrs. Mitchell from Dennis the Menace, and I was fed images of mothers who made hot cocoa with real marshmallows and would cut the edges off your sandwiches. So every Mother's Day, I had to celebrate the glorious steinum of a mother that I was given with the Mrs. Cunningham version from Happy Days that I would have preferred. For the longest time, I thought it was just me, that I was so unmanageably unruly that my mother needed an extra dose of controlling energy to keep me in line. But it didn't occur to me until much later on that being a single mother meant that my mom had to weave together all those many complex and divided roles of a two-parent household into one person with limited time. And sometimes learning that new role is hard. Writer Anne Lamott describes the complex and confusing and impossible set of directions that actually never comes with the package that's delivered when you have a baby. She writes this: when a mother first gives birth, her baby will often be very quiet and sort of spaced out like a little Hindu llama from Mars. And you will think that you got a good one. You didn't. The batteries just haven't arrived yet. They're all the same. On a good day, any baby can make Rush Limbaugh look like the Dalai Lama. But on a bad day, they will cry and kvetch like they've never heard of climate change. And it won't be a moving, tender, don't cry for me, Argentina kind of thing. It's more of a hysterical, self-obsessed Bill O'Reilly on bad acid kind of thing. The good news is that your child will make you fall hopelessly in love with them in a way that will reduce you to something from the Care Bears. The bad news is that you will discover that you now have so much to lose that you'll want to sit on the porch outside your house with a rifle laid over your lap like Granny Clampett. Or as Irma Bombeck described, deciding to have children is deciding that your heart will forever walk around outside of your body, which means that you are constantly extending your domain of interest to include that far edge of your child's wandering attention. So mothers are often found prowling around the perimeter of their children's footsteps, casting a wary eye and sizing up anyone remotely in their child's vicinity. In a sermon last year, I shared the story describing my feelings sometimes about having a very strong mother, and it was the story of my brother Doug and I as we decided we would figure out what would happen if we went down to the corner and pulled the community fire alarm. And neither of us being tall enough to reach the handle, we concocted an elaborate plan to prop my tricycle up against where I could climb up and pull the alarm. And I remember, as we did, the wailing sirens and the fear and trembling that my life might well be over by the time the sun went down, and the specter of big men in yellow jackets standing on top of fire trucks rushing towards us. And I remember quite clearly that as I saw all this happening and I turned back to my house to say goodbye for the last time, I saw my mother walking stridently towards me. She was calm but very determined, and I knew that although she was my salvation from all of this terrible mess, her approach felt rather ominous. And I considered ever so briefly whether I might be better off going with the firemen. And there was no question in my mind that at that very moment, in the heat of that battle, that I was standing square in the path of the army of the Lord. Yes, my mother had to learn how to integrate the divine masculine, that pattern of male territorial behavior. And yes, she was undertaking what many women are asked to do, to learn how to live in this patriarchal, male-oriented society, and to go in there and restore a balance of a world divided by gender norms. And yes, it is hard for our children to make sense of that against the backdrop of Victorian gender roles. But it is equally, if not more true, that men need to integrate more of the divine feminine in what they contribute to our culture, or the violence which has come about will be so dominant that our species will move to ultimate destruction. And the irony is that if our planet ever does reach that threshold of masculine warlike energy without being balanced by any of the divine feminine holding us together, and we do destroy all that is life-giving, the irony is that Mother Earth will simply just shake off our species like a dog walking out of water, and harmony will be restored without us. Julia Ward Howe followed her husband, Samuel Greeley Howe, into the battlefields of the Civil War as he went there to help create the Sanitation Commission. And what she saw broke her heart. She saw boys fighting other boys. Boys who came home a mess or didn't come home at all. And in the midst of war, she called for mothers to lobby for a day when that mothering instinct that might rise up and save all of us could be honored. Are there not a few similarities between mothering children and walking onto a battlefield? Every childhood is a mixture of terror and triumph and tears. There are episodes of plans backfiring and dreams having to be carried out on a stretcher and trying to figure out who is on your side and who isn't. Feeling like you're always under fire or you're out of ammo. And being a mother often means being a combination of medic and field marshal, commandant and confidant. Someone who is willing to go into war to attend the fallen, to find help, to bring supplies, to be that presence of a protector, to offer that promise of peace. Anna Jarvis wanted that. She lobbied to commemorate mothers, to come together for the peace that they might be able to cultivate in a world. And she succeeded in creating the first Mother's Day. But in the later years, as she discovered what that holiday turned into, feeling like it was diminished into sentimentality, becoming nothing more than a time for wayward children to buy flowers for their mothers, she rallied to stop the holiday. So furious was she that she lobbied the public to rethink Mother's Day, asking, quote, "What will you do to rout charlatans, bandits, pirates, racketeers, kidnappers, and other termites that would undermine with their greed one of the finest, noblest, and truest movements and celebrations," end quote. Anna Jarvis went bankrupt in her campaign to end Mother's Day and was unable to pay her bills at the convalescent home where she spent her final years. Interestingly, all her bills were paid, unbeknownst to her, by the flower exchange. To find balance in this off-balance, wayward world, my mother had to learn how to integrate the divine masculine into her approach. And as she did, she insisted that I figure out how to integrate the divine feminine into mine. For she knew that I would not survive, nor would the world survive, without our ability to do that. She taught me a great deal in difficult times in the only way she could. Her truth is marching on to the glory of life.